Chapter 26 is the best place for that sort of job. Live and let live. No questions asked. None of your dirty newspapers. Great country, this. No hypocrisy. They understand life over here. Susie gazed and listened. She remembered that people had thought Nelson would make a row when he found out. He had always been addicted to truculent anecdotes about unfaithful wives, and the very formula of his perpetual ejaculation, "Odilatit, eh?" seemed to hint at a constant preoccupation with such ideas. But now it was evident that, as the saying was, he had swallowed his dose like all the others. No strong blast of indignation had momentarily lifted him above his normal stature. He remained a little man among little men, and his eagerness to rebuild his life with all the old smiling optimism reminded Susie of the patient industry of an ant remaking its ruined ant heap. Tell you what, great thing, this liberty. Everything's changed nowadays. Why shouldn't marriage be too? A man can get out of a business partnership when he wants to, but the parsons want to keep us noosed up to each other for life. Because we've blundered into a church one day, and said yes before one of them. No, that's too easy. We've got beyond that. Science, and all these new discoveries. I say the Ten Commandments were made for man, and not man for the commandments. And there ain't a word against divorce in them, anyhow. That's what I tell my poor old mother, who builds everything on her Bible. Find me the place where it says, thou shalt not sue for divorce. ... It makes her wild, poor old lady, because she can't, and she doesn't know how they happen to have left it out. I rather think Moses left it out, because he knew more about human nature than these sniveling modern parsons do. Not that they'll always bear investigating either, but I don't care about that. Live and let live, eh, Susie? Haven't we all got a right to our affinities? I hear you're following our example yourself. First-rate idea. I don't mind telling you, I saw it coming on last summer at Venice. Caught you at it, so to speak. Old Nelson ain't as blind as people think. Here, let's open another bottle to the health of Streff and Mrs. Streff. She caught the hand with which he was signaling to the sommelier. This flushed and garrulous Nelson moved her more poignantly than a more heroic figure. Oh, more champagne, please, Nelson. Besides, she suddenly added, it's not true. He stared. Ah, true that you're going to marry Altringham? No. By George, then what on earth did you chuck Nick for? Ain't you got an affinity, my dear? She laughed and shook her head. Do you mean to tell me it's all Nick's doing, then? I don't know. Let's talk of you instead, Nelson. I'm glad you're in such good spirits. I rather thought, he interrupted her quickly, thought I'd cut up a rumpus to some shooting? I know people did. He twisted his mustache, evidently proud of his reputation. Maybe I did see red for a day or two, but I'm a philosopher, first and last. Before I went into banking I'd made and lost two fortunes out west. Well, how did I build them up again? Not by shooting anybody, even myself. By just buckling to, and beginning all over again. That's how. And that's what I am doing now. Beginning all over again. His voice dropped from boastfulness to a note of wistful melancholy. The look of strained jauntiness fell from his face like a mask, and for an instant she saw the real man, old, ruined, lonely. Yes, that was it. He was lonely, desperately lonely, foundering in such deep seas of solitude, that any presence out of the past was like a spar to which he clung. Whatever he knew or guessed of the part as he had played in his disaster, it was not callousness that had made him greet her with such forgiving warmth, but the same sense of smallness, insignificance and isolation which perpetually hung like a cold fog on her own horizon. Suddenly she too felt old and unspeakably tired. It's been nice seeing you, Nelson. But now I must be getting home. He offered no objection, but asked for the bill, resumed his jaunty air, while he scattered largesse among the waiters, and sauntered out behind her after calling for a taxi. They drove off in silence. Susie was thinking. Andy Clarissa, but dared not ask. Vanderlyn lit a cigarette, hummed a dance tune, and stared out of the window. Suddenly she felt his hand on hers. Susie, do you ever see her? See Ellie? He nodded, without turning toward her. Not often. ... sometimes. If you do, for God's sake tell her I'm happy. ... happy as a king. ... tell her you could see for yourself that I was. His voice broke in a little gasp. ... I'll be damned if she shall ever be unhappy about me. ... if I can help it. The cigarette dropped from his fingers, and with a sob he covered his face. Oh, poor Nelson, Susie breathed. While their cab rattled across the Place du Carrousel, and over the bridge, he continued to sit beside her with hidden face. At last he pulled out a scented handkerchief, rubbed his eyes with it, and groped for another cigarette. I'm all right. Tell her that, will you, Susie? There are some of our old times I don't suppose I shall ever forget, but they make me feel kindly to her, and not angry. I didn't know it would be so, beforehand, but it is. ... and now the thing's settled, I'm as right as a trivet, and you can tell her so. ... look here, Susie. ... he caught her by the arm as the taxi drew up at her hotel. ... her I understand, will you? I'd rather like her to know that. ... I'll tell her, Nelson, she promised, and climbed the stairs alone to her dreary room. Susie's one fear was that Strefford, when he returned the next day, should treat their talk of the previous evening as a fit of nerves to be jested away. He might, indeed, resent her behavior too deeply, to seek to see her at once, but his assiduous modern attitude toward conduct and convictions made that improbable. He had an idea that what he had most minded was her dropping so unceremoniously out of the embassy dinner. But, after all, why should she see him again? He had had enough of explanations during the last months to have learned how seldom they explain anything. If the other person did not understand at the first word, at the first glance even, subsequent elucidation served only to deepen the obscurity. And she wanted above all and, especially since her hour with Nelson Vanderlyn, to keep herself free, aloof, to retain her hold on her precariously recovered self. She sat down, and wrote to Strefford, and the letter was only a little less painful to write than the one he had dispatched to Nick. It was not that her own feelings were in any like measure engaged, but because, as the decision to give up Strefford affirmed itself, she remembered only his kindness, his forbearance, his good humor, and all the other qualities he had always liked in him, and because she felt ashamed of the hesitations which must cause him so much pain and humiliation. Yes, humiliation chiefly. She knew that what he had to say would hurt his pride, in whatever way she framed her enunciation. And her pen wavered, hating its task. Then she remembered Vanderlyn's words about his wife. There are some of our old times I don't suppose I shall ever forget, and a phrase of Grace Fulmer's that he had but half grasped at the time. Who haven't been married long enough to understand how trifling such things seem in the balance of one's memories. Here were two people who had penetrated farther than she into the labyrinth of the wedded state, and struggled through some of its thorniest passages, and yet both, one consciously, the other half unaware, testified to the mysterious fact which was already dawning on her, that the influence of a marriage begun in mutual understanding is too deep not to reassert itself even in the moment of flight and denial. The real reason is that you're not Nick was what she would have said to Strefford, if he had dared to set down the bare truth, and she knew that, whatever she wrote, he was too acute not to read that into it. He'll think it's because I'm still in love with Nick. ... and perhaps I am. But even if I were, the difference doesn't seem to lie there, after all. But deeper, in things we've shared that seem to be meant to outlast love, or to change it into something different. If she could have hoped to make Strefford understand that, the letter would have been easy enough to write, but she knew just at what point his imagination would fail, in what obvious and superficial inferences it would rest. Poor Streff, poor me, she thought as she sealed the letter. After as he had dispatched it, a sense of blankness descended on her. As he had succeeded in driving from her mind all vain hesitations, doubts, returns upon herself. Her healthy system naturally rejected them. But they left a queer emptiness in which her thoughts rattled about as thoughts might, she supposed, in the first moments after death before one got used to it. To get used to being dead. That seemed to be her immediate business. And she felt such a novice at it, felt so horribly alive. How had those others learned to do without living? Nelson, well, he was still in the throes, and probably never would understand, or be able to communicate, the lesson when he had mastered it. But Grace Fulmer, she suddenly remembered that Grace was in Paris, and set forth to find her. XXIV, Nick Lansing had walked out a long way into the Campagna. His hours were seldom his own, for both Mr. and Mrs. Hicks were becoming more and more addicted to sudden, and somewhat imperious demands upon his time. But on this occasion he had simply slipped away after luncheon, and taking the tram to the Porta Salaria, had wandered on thence in the direction of the Pont Nomentano. He wanted to get away and think, but now that he had done it the business proved as unfruitful as everything he had put his hand to since he had left Venice. Think about what? His future seemed to him a negligible matter, since he had received, 2 months earlier, the few lines in which Susie had asked him for her freedom. The letter had been a shock, though he had fancied himself so prepared for it, yet it had also, in another sense, been a relief, since, now that at last circumstances compelled him to write to her, they also told him what to say. And he had said it as briefly and simply as possible, telling her that he would put no obstacle in the way of her release, that he held himself at her lawyer's disposal to answer any further communication, and that he would never forget their days together, or cease to bless her for them. That was all. He gave his Roman banker's address, and waited for another letter, but none came. Probably the formalities, whatever they were, took longer than he had supposed. And being in no haste to recover his own liberty, he did not try to learn the cause of the delay. From that moment, however, he considered himself virtually free, and ceased, by the same token, to take any interest in his own future. His life seemed as flat as a convalescent's first days after the fever has dropped. The only thing he was sure of was that he was not going to remain in the Hicks' employ. When they left Rome for Central Asia, he had no intention of accompanying them. The part of Mr. Buttle's successor was becoming daily more intolerable to him, for the very reasons that had probably made it most gratifying to Mr. Buttle's. To be treated by Mr. and Mrs. Hicks as a paid oracle, a paraded and petted piece of property, was a good deal more distasteful than he could have imagined any relation with these kindly people could be. And since their aspirations had become frankly social, he found his task, if easier, yet far less congenial than during his first months with them. He preferred patiently explaining to Mrs. Hicks, for the 100th time, that Sasanian and Saracenic were not interchangeable terms, to unraveling for her the genealogies of her titled guests, and reminding her, when she ate at her dinner parties, that dukes ranked higher than princes. No, the job was decidedly intolerable, and he would have to look out for another means of earning his living. But that was not what he had really got away to think about. He knew he should never starve. He had even begun to believe again in his book. What he wanted to think of was Susie, or rather, it was Susie that he could not help thinking of, on whatever train of thought he set out. Again and again he fancied he had established a truce with the past. Had come to terms, the terms of defeat and failure, with that bright enemy called happiness. And, in truth, he had reached the point of definitely knowing that he could never return to the kind of life that he and Susie had embarked on. It had been the tragedy of their relation that loving aroused in him ideals she could never satisfy. He had fallen in love with her because she was, like himself, amused, unprejudiced, and disenchanted. And he could not go on loving her unless she ceased to be all these things. From that circle there was no issue, and in it he desperately revolved. If he had not heard such persistent rumors of her remarriage to Lord Altringham, he might have tried to see her again. But, aware of the danger and the hopelessness of a meeting, he was, on the whole, glad to have a reason for avoiding it. Such, at least, he honestly supposed to be his state of mind until he found himself, as on this occasion, free to follow out his thought to its end. That end, invariably, was Susie, not the bundle of qualities and defects into which his critical spirit had tried to sort her out, but the soft blur of identity, of personality, of eyes, hair, mouth, laugh, tricks of speech and gesture that were also solely and profoundly her own, and yet so mysteriously independent of what she might do, say, think, in crucial circumstances. He remembered her once saying to him, "After all, you were right when you wanted me to be your mistress," and the indignant stare of incredulity with which he had answered her. Yet in these hours it was the palpable image of her that clung closest, till, as invariably happened, his vision came full circle, and feeling her on his breast he wanted her also in his soul. Well, such all-encompassing loves were the rarest of human experiences. He smiled at his presumption in wanting no other. Wearily he turned, and tramped homeward through the winter twilight. At the door of the hotel he ran across the Prince of Teutoburg's aide-de-camp. They had not met for some days, and Nick had a vague feeling that if the prince's matrimonial designs took definite shape he himself was not likely, after all, to be their chosen exponent. He had surprised, now and then, a certain distrustful coldness under the prince's mother's cordial glance. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.